call the Judiciary Interim Committee back to order. Joint Interim Committee. Senator Prosansky.
Thank you. We're going to go ahead and start our next presentation. This is going to be on veterans issues before the courts. We have Chief Justice Paul Menes again that will be leading off. Mitzi Nuckler, I believe.
Nuckler.
Will be here with the State Bar. And then we have Ed Caleb and Steve Tilson who are on the phone. First, let's just make certain. Ed, Steve, can you hear us okay?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. Chief, you like to get started?
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for purposes of this hearing, my name is Paul Menes, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. It's a privilege for me to introduce this next topic of veterans in front of the courts as an issue that resonates with me personally. More than 40 years ago, I returned from my own combat tour in Vietnam. And now I'm honored to participate in some of the mobilizations and welcome home ceremonies for the men and women of our own National Guard. This hearing today is, in my view, but one symbol of the broad support that our troops have today. But it also is a recognition of the challenges that some of our veterans face when they return home. Many survive the battlefield, but can struggle with physical injuries as well as more hidden impacts like traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. Given untreated mental health conditions as well as the challenges of drugs and alcohol, it's no surprise that some of our veterans find themselves in trouble with the law and in front of our courts. Because of those challenges, you'll hear today how the courts and the legal community have responded to assist veterans, not by giving them a free pass, but by ensuring that they get the benefits to which they are entitled, and by giving them the specialized attention that they need to use those services to return to a productive civilian life. Our courts in this state have a tremendous opportunity to help these veterans in transition who are struggling. Understanding our veterans' experiences and connecting them to broad community resources can help to ensure struggling veterans are put on the right course. Our veterans are among our best citizens, and they and their families are truly a resilient group. Early intervention can ensure their continued success, and I'm proud of the work in the public safety community and in our courts to help lead this effort. That said, I'll turn it over to the other members who are here, to either on the phone or present. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Mitzi Nuckler. I'm the current president of the Oregon State Bar. I'm a practicing lawyer in Albany, Oregon. And I'm here today to talk about two things, actually, things that the bar has done in the past and things that they're going to continue to do to assist both service members, active service members, and veterans. In approximately 2003-2004, the bar joined with the Oregon Judicial Department to institute the Military Assistance Panel at the Oregon State Bar. Since then, and currently, we have about 110 lawyers who have volunteered to provide at least 1 hour of free counsel advice to active active service members and or their families and people who've been recently returned. That panel has served in excess of 700 clients since its inception, and that has helped a lot for deployed or active duty military members to access all of the their legal rights that they're entitled to, that the under various federal and state statutes. Currently, we have launched, starting on Veterans Day, November 11th, 2011, we started a program called Lawyers for Veterans. And I'm just appointed a task force, that a steering committee that is charged with developing recommendations to the Oregon State Bar and OJD for meeting the unmet legal needs of Oregon veterans and service members. We think it's very important that veterans obtain all of the benefits they're entitled to once they return. We hope to increase pro bono attorney involvement in family law matters. We hope to get attorneys to assist veterans with their VA benefits claims, including survivorship. Just recently, the federal government allowed attorneys to collect actual attorney's fees for veterans benefits claims that used to be just a flat charge of $10. So obviously, lawyers are much more interested in taking these cases now. We have lots of underemployed and unemployed lawyers. We hope to hook these up, these lawyers up with veterans. And we hope to get lawyers working with veterans advocates. We also hope just to acknowledge and assist veterans and their communities as they return to life at home into civilian life. Thank you.
Thank you.
First, let's see. Ed and Steve, I think you're both together. Did one of you two want to start off for our presentations from Klamath County?
Yeah, my name is Ed Caleb. I'm Klamath County District Attorney since 1985. A couple years ago, I was watching a public TV station. I was in the middle of an election year, and I caught the tail end of this presentation on Veterans Court. I had never heard of Veterans Court, didn't realize we had one, went online and found out back east, especially in the Buffalo area, Pittsburgh area, they got tons of them. I decided I'd like to want to look into it. I met with Kathy Pierce, who runs the local county veterans office, and she pointed out the leading veterans to go talk to at the VFW and the Marine Corps League. Found a judge, which like everything fell in place for us. Marcy Warner Atkinson agreed to do this. She's the wife of Johnny Atkinson, who used to run the show out at Kingsley Field here. So she was into it. We set up meetings with these guys, and everybody was on board wanting to have it happen. And the only trouble was figuring out how to pay for treatment for these guys. And then our whole world changed when the White City VA came over, Mr. Barrett and Mr. Skinner, saying they'll take care of that whole process, get the people over from Klamath Falls over to White City near Medford. And that eliminated that. We got the Klamath Defense Services, which is the defense attorneys here who assigned an attorney for it, so the rest of the attorneys could send the possible client in there. We got, right about that same time, we got a coordinator. Steve Tilson came in from the juvenile department to be the coordinator for all the specialty courts. He was looking online one day and found a training and free training in Buffalo that we applied for, and somehow miraculously got it. And so we sent, what, Steve, 10, 12 people back? 10 people back for free for a week of training. And now we've got a mentoring element also, so these guys that are on awaiting sentencing or going through whatever they're going through, maybe they'll have somebody who used to be in the military to talk to. And then just recently we just celebrated our first anniversary, and we're really happy with what's going on. I think we were the first, if not, it still may be the only true veterans court in the state of Oregon, so we're real proud of it. That's all I have. Here's Steve Tilson.
Yes, well, this is Steve Tilson, treatment court coordinator for the circuit court in Klamath County. And I would just like to add that The formation of the Veterans Court relied quite a bit on the principles of drug courts. It is essentially a treatment court adapted to the needs, circumstances, and resources available to the veteran. And as such, there is a tremendous body of knowledge and expertise available in the state of Oregon through the treatment court community that is already in place. Oregon is home to drug courts in most, if not all, of its judicial districts. And that expertise is at hand now and available to assist jurisdictions that are looking at formation of a Veterans Treatment Court. And I have to echo Mr. Caleb's statement about the partnership with the VA, and we could not have put our court together without the partnership, the collaboration, and the services available through the Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you.
Thank you. Opening up the panel for any questions from anyone. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Steve, on that anniversary celebration, there were some figures made public, and I believe off the top of my head, it was something like you had 28 cases over that first year, and your success rate was virtually 100% in keeping the veterans out of in incarceration or further problems with the law. Is that about right?
That's about right. We currently have 29 veterans enrolled, and probably a total of 20 days incarceration for three of those veterans that have encountered some trouble along their path to wellness. And so I couldn't compare that to how many days this group might have ordinarily been incarcerated, but I expect that the 20 days that our group has experienced is far less than what they might have normally experienced.
I'd say that would be correct.
Very much.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Take a comment.
Senator Wisnett. Excuse me, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have two questions. First for Mrs. Nosler. Thank you very much, and for your BART members for doing this. How are you advertising this? And I think it'd be very critical that the information about the program be given to our federal legislators, because when we get the legislators, usually when we get questions from veterans, we turn them over to our federal elected officials because they have the expertise. But I would hope that your services that the bar wants to provide, that they would be sure that that gets to our federal delegation and around to the veterans' offices. But thank you for doing that. For Mr. Tilson, this is great. A friend of mine serves Mr. Willis's Veterans Advisory Committee. Dave Fairclough talked to me about the drug court. I didn't think it was any possible way we could fund it. How are you going to continue this once the grant money runs away? And also then, I guess, for this committee, the same gentleman, Mr. Fairclough, that served on Mr. Willis's committee for many years. Now, one of the things is maybe don't get them in the courts, these veterans that have problems, is he talked about maybe on their driver's license we could put, you know, veteran for a certain period of time or something like that if they're coming back from combat or something like
that. That is an option now. The veterans do have the ability to have listed on their
driver's
DL.
License. Okay, good. I guess the question then, Mr. Chair, to Mr. Tilson is how are you going to be able to maintain this? I think it's a great service, but how are you going to maintain your treatment court for veterans?
Yes, this is Steve Tilson. First of all, it might come as a surprise that the program, the Veterans Treatment Court program, has received no grants and no supplemental funding for its formation or its operation. Our program budget is exactly $0.00. We function because these cases would be in the court anyway. The judge would have to see the veteran defendant. A defense attorney would have to work with the veteran defendant. The prosecutor's office would have to create the charging instrument, and prosecute the case. And what we did was realign our existing resources spent on those cases, put them together in a coordinated fashion, and expend an additional hour of time in team staffing each week before case call to problem solve, to review status reports, to see what we can do to best respond to that veteran's progress in any given week. We have a volunteer mentor coordinator. We solicit donations for incentives to reward the veteran for positive progress. So sustainability is likely to occur in that very same fashion. We have no program budget for our operation.
This is Ed Caleb. The only problem we could run into, when we're looking at austere budget cuts here in Klamath County. Hopefully they won't cut the DA's office to the point where we won't have somebody to service drug court, but our vets court, but I think we can get through that. That'd be the only thing that I could think about that would be really damaging at this time.
Coach Barker?
Thank you. Just a few comments. I think I want to first of all thank the attorneys of Oregon that are giving their time to do this. Without the volunteer time, the pro bono work, it wouldn't be getting done. And I appreciate that not only from the defense bar, but also for the extra efforts from the district attorney's office. I think it's really important. America now, we don't count on a widespread demographic to serve in the military. We're getting less and less families involved. There's one, I think 1% now is serving in the military, and that makes a difference. And I hope these courts, especially we have these citizen soldiers who are kind of taken out of their daily life, and they're not doing the 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer fun time. They're being sent over into some really serious combat situations in a totally different part of the world. And to come back here, it's we all know that a lot of people have a difficult time adjusting. I think it's even tougher for the National Guard people who are not career soldiers, who are just they are career soldiers, but in a different light. And I really appreciate the efforts people are making to help people get back on their feet when they get home and stay, be productive citizens, not prisoners. Thank you.
We appreciate that. Klamath was probably the perfect place to do it because we can't agree on anything except that we love our veterans. We nothing else but that we can agree on.
All right. Is there any other comments? If not, I want to first thank Ms. Knockler for your presentation and congratulations to your position at the bar. I think it's very important that, as you've heard from other panel members, the Lawyers for Veterans is something that we all are very appreciative that the bar is taking on. I know for my dealings with constituents, and I think probably everyone at this dais would say they've had individuals who have called who are veterans who need legal assistance, and it's really hard trying to put them together with others. Another person I think that's worth mentioning that's been very instrumental in this is Jess Barton, who's been very instrumental here at the Capitol, working with all of us in dealing with issues that involve veterans in the legal arena. And so with that, I want to thank you for being here. And gentlemen on the phone, Ed and Steve, thank you very much for your time. And unless you want to stay on and listen to the next presentation on Oregon elder abuse, we'll go ahead and disconnect you unless you want to stay on.
No, we'll leave. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
And our last informational meeting is for a report on the Oregon Elder Abuse Work Group. And I did see Representative Gillum here, and I believe Representative Poyle is supposed to be joining us. Also, John Whitworth and then Matt Smith. And if y'all are here, please come forward. And Vic, we're going to let you kind of lead on this. Maybe Representative Poyle would join you.
I think she's on the way. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vic Gilliam, I'm the state representative from District 18. And I appreciate very much your taking a look at some of the work that's been done on this issue, especially in the form of LC 259, which is being passed out right now.
Here's a thought.
It's been my pleasure to be the co-chair of this work group. It's very important that we understand it was a work group, not a task force, because that great Republican thinker, Peter Courtney, would not approve a task force because it costs money. and I like the way he thinks, and I appreciate very much his support, and that's why it is called a work group, not a task force. The task force, you've heard this cliche before, but I witnessed it up close and personal, and that is, it really was the stakeholders coming together, and it was the precursor to this group was a group that the new director at DHS, Aaron Kelly Seal, put together at the Elder the Adult Protective Services Abuse Team. We worked very closely with that group through our last session and dovetailed into this group. And I think that's key to the success of us moving forward with the bill. And I appreciate very much those that were part of both groups, and I appreciate the director's help, that is Aaron Kelly Seal's help in this bill. DHS was instrumental and cooperative along the way. I also want to make sure that I acknowledge my co-chair from House Human Services, Carolyn Tomei, who's been very supportive, and tomorrow we will be hearing some of these same issues in our committee. And I appreciate very much. I'm sorry that you, Madam Chair, have to hear this twice, but I look forward to seeing you tomorrow as well. We're going to get to the meat of this because the gentlemen on my left and right are really the people you want to hear from. I wanted to kick this off and make sure you understand how important this is to our most vulnerable elderly citizens in the state of Oregon, and thank you for your attention. And I know Mr. Chair will be able to hear from you as well in this panel, either there or here, your choice.
At the end.
Okay. And with that, I'll turn it over to these gentlemen and allow them to identify and introduce themselves. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Wentworth. I'm a prosecutor with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office, and I am the elder abuse prosecutor in our office. I've been a part of this work group from the beginning, and by way of understanding some of the work that's gone into this work group, the way I've described it to others is that the way we deal with elder abuse in Oregon currently lags about 25 years behind where we were in child abuse investigation and prosecution and dealing with that problem. MDTs are currently being formed, multidisciplinary teams involving social services and law enforcement and prosecutors, just now, where we've been doing that in the realm of elder abuse or child abuse for decades. And as a prosecutor, that can create a great deal of frustration because I prosecuted child abuse, and so there were many tools at my disposal that I didn't have when I started taking over handling elder abuse. This work that you see before you addresses some of those concerns. One of the things that I noticed when I started handling elder abuse cases, for example, was that we have a felony statute designed to protect vulnerable children from intentional or knowing physical injury that they are subjected to. That's under the Assault 3 statute. But I thought it was interesting that we didn't have a comparable statute that would protect elders in a similar situation. Now, under the criminal mistreatment statute, there is some protection to elders if the person who is committing the assault is a caregiver. But as a prosecutor, I can tell you that I've seen cases where I have adult children, for example, assaulting their elderly parents, but they're not acting in a caregiving capacity. Under Oregon law, that's currently a misdemeanor. So we're missing the boat in protecting some of our most vulnerable victims that we see in our office, and we don't necessarily have to have it that way. So one of the proposals that we've made is to make a comparable statute to protect elders like we have to protect children from similar abuse. Another important component of this legislation is on page 5 of your packet, which deals with the statute of limitations. Under what's currently ORS 131125, law enforcement officers have essentially, if you think of the statute of limitations for a felony, typically it's 3 years. If there is an element of fraud involved, and this is whether there's elder abuse involved or not, if there's an element of fraud, We have one more year to investigate that crime beyond the statute of limitations for no more than up to 6 years. The problem, and the detective can back me up, I believe, if you want to hear from him, is that oftentimes investigations that are more complicated can take more than a year. Just getting bank records, getting financial documents, and figuring out what we're working with can take a great deal of time. But what's more frustrating is that elder abuse can occur over a long period of time, over a number of years. So as a prosecutor, I end up having to share with the victim's family or the victim themselves that I can prosecute a fraction of the total amount that was taken rather than getting the full amount that would be possible. So because the statute currently gives us the option of going up to 6 years in the most extreme or unusual of circumstances, what would be most helpful is to simply have a 6-year statute of limitations to allow us to capture, I think, a fuller amount of restitution that would be owed to the victim, because oftentimes we're getting up into the, it's not unusual to have 6 digits lost from someone's livelihood or from a victim's estate, because sometimes these investigations outlive sometimes the victim. The third area of, I think, improvement, and what I think I had the greatest concern about when I started taking over these cases, was to learn that a person can act as a caregiver to an elder, actually commit a physical assault on that person. So we're talking about the criminal mistreatment statute. But 3 years after successfully completing probation, have that crime expunged from the record and re-enter into a care facility and have access to other vulnerable adults. And that would be true whether there is financial abuse or physical abuse. So what we're proposing on page 10, I believe, of your packet is that criminal mistreatment be listed as one of the crimes that cannot be expunged from someone's record. That would be someone who's acting in a care capacity who commits a crime of financial abuse or physical abuse under someone who is in their care, or with someone who is in their care. We simply don't believe that that type of person is someone who should be caring for elders, or at least we want to make sure that we have a record so that if I'm a family member and I want to see whether a facility has someone working for them who has a criminal history, I can research that and not worry that perhaps they have committed some sort of abuse against an elder in the past and no one knows. So those are the three areas that I wanted to focus on and bring to your attention that I think would greatly improve the safety to our elders in Oregon.
All right, thank you. Matt?
Thank you. My name is Matt Smith, and I'm currently serving as a detective at the Forest Grove Police Department. Thank you for allowing me to address all of you today. Mr. Wentworth is exactly right that we're about 20 or 25 years behind in the way we do business protecting our senior citizens. I spend probably about half my time investigating child sex abuse, and the other half investigating some form of elder abuse. And it's striking how far we've come in child abuse and how far we have to go in elder abuse. Specifically, that in nearly half my cases, my victims die before these cases are adjudicated. And probably more than half my cases, my victims have dementia that is so extensive that I have to write search warrants just to get copies of records indicating that they have dementia in the first place and they lack capacity to give loans to people. And number two, then I have to write search warrants for their financial records. As a result, I can be waiting months just to obtain records from my victims. If this was any other type of crime, I could simply walk up to my victim and ask for consent to look at their bank records. Currently in Oregon, we can't do that as police officers, and DHS cannot do that as well. As a result of that, we're finding out that it's taken me between 6 months to a year to fully complete my investigations and deliver them to the DA's office so they're ready for prosecution. What this bill addresses, specifically sections 6 through 12, is that if we get a report of that we have a senior citizen who's the victim of elder abuse, we'd be able to go to a financial institution, inform them that our subject is the victim of a crime, and be able to obtain at least a basic copy of financial records to indicate that these people are losing money. The ability to do this might be able to allow law enforcement to prevent livelihoods from being lost in the meantime. The second concept that's outlined in this bill is the ability for law enforcement personnel and DHS personnel to obtain medical records. This is important because in virtually every case that I've investigated, when we find tens of thousands of dollars missing, the excuse is usually that this is a loan or a gift. And by a quick look at the medical records, if a person has dementia and has had it for years, it's highly improbable this person's giving out tens of thousands of dollars in the form of loans to people. And it becomes a cornerstone of our investigations. Currently, I'm having to write search warrants for that, and as a result, I'm being inundated with medical records that I really don't need. All I really need to be able to do is sit down with a primary care physician and speak with them and get a very brief copy of a medical record to indicate that we have somebody here who's suffering from a medical problem, and as a result, can't even communicate with me. What's striking is that a lot of cases that are coming to our attention now are so egregious that you have financial institutions calling our agency. Just last week, we had a bank call us and tell us we have a victim of elder abuse who's a customer, but we can't talk to you about it. So literally what we had through APS was a name, and we went out and did an investigation based on that. I've had conversations with physicians where they're informing us, you know, my patient is probably a victim of elder abuse, but I can't talk to you. So in a sense, we have financial institutions and physicians who want to do the right thing for their patients and their customers, but they aren't able to do that. This bill addresses that specifically, where it absolves them of civil liabilities to communicate with law enforcement and DHS if they determine that a patient or a customer is clearly the victim of elder abuse. And it's going to give us the tools to be able to intervene and protect people's lives and livelihoods in the process.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
You may.
Thank you. I just want to go back to a previous statement you made. You said that you can't get financial statements or any kind of information. I'm assuming you're meaning if somebody has dementia. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Otherwise, they could, if they have an intact mind, they can give you that permission, right?
That's correct.
I just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
All right. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm a bit rusty. It's probably a simple question, but subpoena duces tecum is not available for the financial records. Is that right?
Not in Washington County. In Washington County, I'm required to write search warrants through my DA's office to obtain these records.
Hmm. Mr. Wentworth?
Why? If we're using it for a grand jury investigation, and at this point, sometimes, you know, they may not know what they have yet. And so there's an argument that can be made that would be an improper use of the grand jury process. And so just doing a grand jury subpoena, our county actually uses them more liberally.
Okay.
But not all counties are comfortable with doing that.
Okay. I see. Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty liberal.
Yeah. So, but I can see the problem. Okay.
We're getting records.
All right, go ahead.
Another section of the bill that addresses that we wanted to address was adding four additional crimes to the Never Never Clause of being able to seek employment in the industry. The four crimes being animal abuse in the first degree, aggravated animal abuse in the first degree, forgery in the first degree, and child neglect in the first degree. And conversely, there were an additional set of crimes that we wanted to adjust, in a sense, to allow a way test before somebody was to be barred from employment. And those statutes were private indecency, invasion of personal privacy, theft one, theft of services, and computer crime. When I first heard about these, I was a little skeptical in the line of work I was in, but as it was explained to me and as I read through the statutes, I kind of saw the logic in it pretty quickly. Private indecency and invasion of personal privacy in some ways are kind of vague statutes, especially as an officer when I applied them. It can be so far as a couple having a consensual encounter, maybe in a public place where they use some bad judgment, to somebody who's really doing something improper in public. And there's a big distinction between those two acts. This way test would allow somebody who maybe made a mistake 15 to 20 years ago not to be barred from employment if they've had a clean record and led a good life ever since. It allows that distinction to be made. Again, for theft one, there have been times where I've charged people for theft one and arrested them for it, where they've just merely taken their parents' car without permission when they were 18 years old. And I'd hate to see somebody 20 years later be barred from employment again if they have had an opportunity to make a good life for themselves. And again, there's a way test involved here where that determination can be made. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be granted employment.
Mr. Chair, what is weight test? Is that what is weight?
W-E-I-G-H-T? A weight test. Where it's been
balancing.
Is that what it's
yes.
Weight? Okay, thank you.
Basically, I think what we're hearing is that individuals that may have some blemish in their past would be eligible to still be employed if they go through this test and it balances out and the employer knows and it's going to be full disclosure, et cetera.
Correct.
Thank you.
Again, I believe very strongly that certain provisions in this bill, specifically Section 6 through 12, have the potential to do a lot of good for this state and it's going to dramatically affect law enforcement in a positive way. I appreciate the ability to address you all today.
All right, well, thank you.
Representative Gillum, I see Representative Hoyle's assistance here. Is she going to be able to make it, or?
I ask her not to come. She's much more articulate.
Do we say thank you now or later?
I think she's on her way, we hope.
All right.
This is the other court.
If she's here when before we finish, fine. If not, Representative. Got it.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Matt, question to you, and actually, John, you can chime in on this too. I spent 4 years in Human Services Committee with Representative Gilliam and the Madam Chair. It was a very interesting tour of duty. But my question to you, it actually goes to Section 17. And maybe you can enlighten me a little bit about that, but the proposed changes there. Could you kind of clarify that for me? That would be page 21.
I don't know if I'm okay.
It's page 21, starting on line 1, is where the new language would be.
Apparently that's in reference to the way test that I just mentioned previously in my testimony, which is the ability to be able to look at a particular offense and weigh whether or not a person's going to be barred from employment. I think it's important that we add that to make a distinction between somebody being barred for a mistake they made 20 years ago as opposed to a rather egregious mistake they made 6 years ago.
Representative Olson?
Okay. Thank you. I'm fine.
Representative Schaffler?
Yeah, I have two questions. The first one, so we have mandatory reporting for child abuse. There's no mandatory reporting of potential elder abuse, and could you do that?
There is mandatory reporting for elder abuse. interestingly, with regard to specific professions, for example, attorneys, we have a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week reporting obligation. In many of the professions listed in the elder abuse side, those obligations only extend to your professional contact. So if I see child abuse while I'm mowing my lawn, I'm an attorney, I have to report that. Theoretically, now I'm not saying I would do this, it would be immoral, but if I saw elder abuse, I wouldn't be required to report that. So that's an area where we're actually lagging behind a little bit, but that's not something that we've addressed in this legislation.
And Mr. Chair, one more, and I support what you're doing, and I'm really grateful you're doing it. It's very serious, but I can't help asking this question of my colleague. Did your grandchildren give you that sweater for Christmas?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. If you must know, President Courtney gave this to me for Christmas, and I thought it would help the bill if I wore it.
Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, not anything to do with Representative Schaffler, but I just would ask you the question. When we get trained for mandatory reporting, has anybody ever in your years of being trained been told elder abuse was part of it in our training? And I can't remember it, and I've been asking others.
It's not. That's just what we've just heard, is that it's not a requirement at this point unless you're in certain relationships with that individual. And then I think what we've said at this point is a state, the policy is those individuals have this duty. Whether we should expand that out further, I think that's going to be a discussion probably the next session.
I'm just going to say I'm pleased to see the restriction on reemployment, because so often in the paper I'll read elder abuse where somebody is taking care of the old man and cleans out the bank account, and then you read on down, the next paragraph says, and in 2006 they did the same thing to somebody else, and so that's good that you can get that locked down. thank you for the work you're doing.
I guess what I want to do is close at this point. I want to thank the work group that has been meeting. I had the opportunity to participate in a couple of the live meetings in person, as well as those on phone. And as I think Representative Gillum said, I think the best way that we get our work done is actually let the interested parties get together and help, let them help us help others in the sense of directing us. So, gentlemen, for you and for everyone else that has been part of this work group, it's very important that you realize how important it is for your participation. I know you take time out of your days, your work, your obligations, and for your employers, please make certain that they understand that we really appreciate you having the time to put forward, and that the goal at this point is to move forward to give us some of a roadmap through the 2012 session so we can continue the work and then bring back a full process and policy decisions to be made in 2013. So with that, unless there's anything else that we need to do, Representative Olson, did you have anything else? Just wanted to make sure.
Thank you.
All right. And since Representative Hoyle has not been able to make it, we'll just have to keep her comments to the next time we meet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee is adjourned. House side is adjourned.
And the Senate will adjourn its Senate committee until we meet in February.